in a second-hand set of dimensions, on an astral plane that was never meant to fly, through wavering star mists, see the Greater Tuin. Drifting onwards through space, atop the shell of the world's turtle, are four giant elephants, upon whose broad shoulders rests the Discworld. Welcome to Dining Table Discworld. We're reading through the Discworld novels and discussing them at our dining table. Be aware, there will be spoilers for the current book, and others in the series.
Hello, and welcome to Dining Table Discworld. I'm Dave.
I'm Kathy.
And today we'll be talking about Mort by Terry Pratchett. This is the fourth Discworld novel, and it was published in 1987. The synopsis.
Mort is at an awkward age when his father decides he's not suited for life on the farm and takes him off to be apprenticed. Mort's master turns out to be a skeleton in a cow with a scythe and a big white horse, so death, the Grim Reaper. No one else quite seems to see that, though. Mort is shown things few other mortals see as he watches death do his duty. Death's household also includes his manservant Albert, a greasy, cynical old fellow, and Death's adopted daughter Isabel, a strong-willed young woman who has been a teenager for too long. On his first solo outing, Mort neglects the duty to save a princess and damages reality. Meanwhile, Death uses his newfound free time, attempting to learn more about human life. This means Mort is increasingly pulled away from his own humanity and into the vacant role of skeletal psychopomp. With time literally running out for various characters, will they be able to correct Mort's mistake and bring Death back to his proper place?
Okay, so, initial impressions.
I remember that I liked the book when I first read it, and it is one of the Discworld books I've reread, but probably only a little bit. I did like how inventive it is. I don't remember like a lot else from the first reading. Now it's still good, but I feel like I've perhaps outgrown it a little bit. Yeah. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, this again, I've read this one quite a lot. I enjoyed the death sequence. I think that's possibly my favourite sequence in the Discworld series. So yeah, I do enjoy this one. I think primarily because it introduces death as a character, which we'll go into later. So yes, it's a good one. I mean, we can always go back to our test of, is it a good one to get people to start with?
I feel like it probably is.
I think this is not a bad one to a jumping in point.
Of the ones we've done so far, this feels like the first one where I'd recommend it to somebody who hadn't read it before.
Yeah, I mean you're not gonna miss out on anything really referenced in the preview. But you know, I think it's a strong good one. So yes, both enjoyed it. But
yeah.
Right then, on to our list of notes.
I think the main question was that if this had been published in the 21st century rather than 20th century, would it be a YA?
Maybe.
I'd lean towards yes.
Well, I said maybe. For me, that would be come down to whether it was worth marketing it away from the other novels.
I feel like we're looking at it on its own at the moment, because yeah. If we're positing that it was published in the 21st century, presumably the other ones were as well.
And... Okay. I mean, it's got strong elements of a YA novel.
It's very coming of age.
Yeah, a teenage protagonist.
More than one.
Yes, okay.
Like at least three of the characters are teenagers.
I mean, one is... is a teenager, but 35-year-old.
If you're going to say that she's been a teenager for a long time, allow me to point you to many, many vampire books.
I felt that the vampires should have at least have the they don't have the excuse of living in a world where nothing happens. But anyway,
that's what being a teenager can be like. We were both teenagers in the countryside. Like, yeah.
So anyway, so yes, you've got teenage protagonists. Yes, coming of age, a boy finding himself.
A farm boy saves a princess, but with a twist.
Yes.
But the twist isn't that she turns out to be a sister, because George Lucas has already done that.
That's fair. So yeah, it's got some strong YA credentials there.
I mean, I feel like a lot of the plot is driven by Mort being a young man. Like, he's like a 16-year-old boy, that's...
The key...
Why a lot of things happen.
The key, you know, plot point of him failing to reap the princess and instead saving her is very very 16-year-old boy. The only other time so the two characters have had a previous interaction in the book before the whole death coming to Reaper, in which she simply smiles at him, and that's pretty much enough to make 16-year-old boys do pretty much anything.
I think it depends. It's that after that, he has a couple of times when people ask him if it went all right or ask if he needed help, and he's like, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, there's very much sense of being given your first taste responsibility and then realising you've mucked it up. Who's he speak to afterwards? I mean, Death asks him how it went. Albert sort of does.
Well, because Death asks, because he has three souls to do. One's a witch, one's a reincarnating monk. Albert, yeah. And the third one being princess.
But when he's talking to the witch, he's worried he's mucked it up already and gets a bit upset, and she kind of like comforts him slightly because it's not quite gone exactly how he thought it would. You know, that kind of coming of age, taking responsibility for the first time, and then like it going wrong, you trying to fix it without people finding out. He kind of tells Isabel, like, when they start becoming, like, allies a bit more, she doesn't properly pay attention. And then even then, she's like, oh, sorry, what was that? And he's like, oh, never mind. So he's trying to sort it out himself a bit, and then brings her in a bit. And
well, we've mentioned a few characters there that, you know, so perhaps we should have a chat about some of the characters. So we've obviously got Mort, our main teenage protagonist. I feel is a reasonable representation of a... Well, we don't know how isolated he might have been, but you do feel like he's grown up on a farm, a village.
You get the impression he probably has siblings not mentioned. I think it's just that he's the one that doesn't really seem to fit in there very well.
Yeah.
And his dad's not really sure what to do with him.
I get the impression he's the youngest.
Oh, yeah.
Do we like Mort?
He's fine. I feel like I probably liked him more when I was a teenager.
I mean, yeah, I could see that, you know.
And now I'm a bit like... All right. Ask somebody for some help there, lad.
He's a little less character insert there. I think, yes, I mean, coming at it, reading it as adults, you do kind of go, this could have been solved by simply phoning the X-Men. Sorry, now that's a different problem. Simply telling a person in authority.
I think I've missed that shade of reference, but sure.
Sideline, most X-Men comics in the 80s could be resolved by one X-Men team phoning the other team and actually having a conversation.
But had less telephones in the 80s, but they did still
exist
also
had
then.
Telepaths.
Okay, like now when you can just IM people.
Yes, exactly.
That's why so many TV shows have people running out of battery, because it's a bit like, oh, this would be solved very quickly with modern technology. End of sideline. I feel like this time, felt more about Isabel, and I think I did like her before, because obviously it starts off and Mort's been brought in as the apprentice, even though Death doesn't need an apprentice, and what he hasn't understood, although people kind of in a very roundabout way told him, is that sometimes the apprentice is brought in because, you know, his dad keeps going about nuptials, and clearly Mort doesn't know what that word means, and the whole thing is a bit like, you know, marrying the master's daughter. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of an expectation, also foreshadowing. And Isabel's very haughty to him because he's just the apprentice and she's, you know, the master's daughter. And I think she's also aware that he's been brought in to be a friend of her. It's like, these young people are the same age, they will be friends. It's not how it works. So I think she's a bit annoyed about that, and also the fact that her father's kind of taking pity on her. But she even says at one point in the book, he can't feel pity, he just thinks pity. Yeah. So there's that. And so she is quite uppity at first, but I think that's almost staking her place. But then there's also the fact that she's been reading romance biographies, basically the biographies of people who died tragically for love in various Shakespearean-sounding plots. So it's given her a skewed thing, but again, that sense that she's this teenage girl, she's trapped in a place that she can't leave, time doesn't pass, she's just endlessly kind of waiting for nothing to happen, except that she's been 16, as she says in one point of the book, for 35 years.
Yeah.
For one thing, it has quite, now that I think about it, quite strong 2020 energy.
I suppose so, yes.
She's just stuck with her dad and his servant in one place. She never goes anywhere. Yeah, she never sees anyone. It's very strong 2020 energy.
It has to go out to work.
But I think it's also that kind of teenage malaise of like, I'm going to reference Tangled here, where will my life begin? Obviously, she's trapped in a tower, also very 2020 energy. Yeah. Obviously, a bit more abusive parent dynamics than that particular Disney film. But yes, this kind of teenage feeling of like, there's lots to do, but you're kind of stuck where you are, and you're a bit isolated, and maybe you're a bit lonely, yeah, and maybe you're a bit annoyed. It's just quite relatable. She's not even been given any responsibility. Like, no. Why didn't her father take her out? And in fact, later on, you have the thing that often happens with young women, where it turns out she knows how her father does the nodes, whatever those are. I don't think they mentioned much again, but some sort of complicated part of his job as deaf. And magic, she knows,
balancing energy points. It was all something very important.
Yeah, and Mort, who's his apprentice, and Albert, who we'll get to, you know, they don't know. And Isabel's there like, well, I sit in here with Father all the time, I see him do it. So she's just picked it up. Well,
he's shown her how to do it.
Oh, yes, of course, yes, you're right. No, he's not just shown her.
It's not just she's picked it up. He's actually sat down and showed her.
But I feel like he's shown her in a sort of, not this is something you'll do there, more a sort of like, you're here, I'm parenting you. I will show you.
Oh, no,
a thing.
I didn't. Not yeah. as a. Yeah,
he's not taught her, because he's not taught any of them.
I think he
showed her rather than taught her, if that makes sense. But she's picked it up. Then she's like, well, I'm not going to help you. And I'm like, no, we don't have time. She's like, no, I'm going to do it, and you're going to help me. And then because a young woman's doing it and showing that she knows what to do best, they're all going, oh, yeah, that seems right. She's having to deal with that kind of nonsense, a bit like, you're young and female, you can't possibly know. And it's better than us. It's like, well, she does, and she sourced it.
Yeah. Okay. This is not the first time we've met Isabel, though. We should need to reference back to
Light Fantastic.
Thank you.
She meets Rincewind.
Yes, because Two Flowers
playing bridge
with the four horsemen. We do meet Isabel when Rincewind tries to come, leaves his body and astrally projects to find Two Flowers.
She's just quite excited to meet a living person. She does come off as a bit creepy then, but I think it's more contextual. I think it was just, oh, wouldn't it be funny if Death had like a house that looked regular and his mates have come around for cards. And, oh, here's his daughter, who's a human girl, who's also being a bit weird. But, again, her social skills can't be great. She doesn't see anyone.
No.
Again, she was plucked
from the world at age of 16, which we don't really know much about her.
I don't think she was 16. I thought she was younger, and he just let her age up.
I don't think he can. I don't think...
I just got the impression that 16 was an age he felt was useful to
stop.
Because I thought she was little. She never mentions her parents. I get the impression she was very young in the shipwreck.
It just says shipwreck.
If she was 16, you just like send her on her way. I feel like she was little.
I don't know. I think it's... It, yeah,
I can't remember if it's mentioned in the book specifically. I feel like she was very little. He felt or thought sorry for her.
Yeah.
And took her in and then allowed her to age up to a point that he could handle. And he thought, oh, 16 would probably be fine.
I don't know. It's an unreferenced thing. So our other major female character being Princess Kelly in who's the undead...
She's not dead.
She's not
but
undead.
But you have to say not dead.
She's not dead. She should be dead, but she's not.
Well, she's 15... And her father's been killed, so she's now the queen, except everyone keeps calling her princess still. And then, obviously, Mort should have collected her as part of the duty and didn't. So then you've got this weird thing where history or reality is trying to write itself into a world in which she was killed and her uncle or cousin or something, the Duke. Who, again, everyone's calling the Duke, even though in that reality he'd be king. So I think it's just to clarify, stole the throne through assassination. It's interesting because both her and Mort have this whole thing of having to constantly reaffirm their identities. Because Mort's thing is not everyone, but most people throughout the book keep calling him boy, and he always says Mort, and they just keep calling him boy. I guess probably because he's an apprentice and that's kind of the role thing. Yeah. But also, I suppose it is a bit littling. But then with Kelly, her thing is that quite literally she has to...
remind
people she even exists. Yeah, her thing is that everyone's kind of forgotten. It's a bit like how no one can see, or people mostly can't see death. They just see what they think should be there. In their minds, Kelly shouldn't be there, so it's really difficult to see her. So that's why the wizard Cutwell can see her, and he has to try and remind everyone she exists, and it all gets a bit confusing. But yeah, it gives me that they're both in a situation where they're having to reaffirm their identity. The thing with Kelly is that she, I mean, she's 15, but she acts somewhat older, I think, because, I mean, partly because Discord's kind of setting where, you know, people...
About pseudo-medieval...
I mean, I'd say more early modern, but yeah. But it, I think it's more also, you think that it's written by Pratchett, who was of a generation where actually at 15 you could be getting ready to start up your own household, yeah. Which now is obviously not how things are. Particularly if you look at a lot of his rural books, that is a whole thing in there. Because he does have a lot of capable young women, that's yeah. The whole thing. And obviously Isabel, we've mentioned. Kelly is very capable, but she's almost not been given the chance because she's having to just fight for, I'm here, I exist.
Give me lunch.
Well, yeah, just, you know, just treat me as somebody who exists, which, again, I don't know that he meant it, but it feels like quite a thing, again, like people be very dismissive young women, and she's just having to fight even to be seen. Yeah. Although, obviously, this is also the whole magical causal reason for that.
Yes. So, yes, you kind of feel sorry for her, really, because, you know, she didn't do anything to deserve getting in this mess.
No, but she's determined to die a queen.
Yeah, I think the whole thing, I think, obviously, from her point of view, she doesn't become the queen until she gets crowned.
This is actually the book that has the Speed of Monarchy joke in the footnote.
Oh, yes.
Because I thought it was Pyramids. But Pyramids, we see it happen. This has the Speed of Monarchy joke, but it's just a footnote.
Yeah.
Although talking about whether someone's crowned or not being queen, yes, she wants to be crowned. It always annoys me that in the lists of the English monarchs, they don't include Matilda because she was never crowned, even though she was literally fighting to become queen and was the next in line. But then we always put Jane Grey in there, who, yes, was coronated, but was a small child who was put into a dangerous situation and then executed after 9 days. And it's like, I feel like we're always like, we'll put one in the queen list as a queen, but not the other, even though if you look at their actions, it's like, this is just a child who's manipulated. But anyway, sorry, that's my sidebar. Just what is being a queen more about, whether somebody put a crown on your head when you possibly were too young to understand what was going on, or about actually fighting for the throne, but then sexism meant that you were, you know, rejected.
In this situation, Kelly is fighting for her throne.
Well, that's true.
But she feels like that she doesn't actually get to be queen until she actually gets the crown.
The coronation. Well, I suppose then all the ceremonial stuff.
Ceremony, yeah.
But then they're having to like rush through what should be an hours long.
Yes,
it's ceremony, like, yeah. Just before the
this bubble of reality, collapses in and writes itself. So yeah, I think she's, you know, you don't get to see a lot of her as, you know, I think. No. You get from other people's points of view more than...
Yeah, well, yeah, we don't get much from hers, do we? There's bits, but... You know, and there's the whole thing about how, oh, she's always ready for assassination because she's royal and royals on the disc know they're going to be assassinated. And so it's a bit of a weird life, I suppose. But, you know, she knows what she wants, she knows what she's going to do. It's just everything's difficult and her time is short.
I suppose the next person to bring up would be the wizard Cutwell. You briefly mentioned the wizard. So this is the wizard who lives in...
Stolat.
Stolat, thank you. Who initially is Mort goes to see when he's accidentally walking through things, which is a whole thing about being death, which we'll cover with the death section. But later on, he is...
The Royal Recogniser.
Yes, he was press-ganged into becoming the Royal Recogniser.
Because he's one of the only people that can see it, because he's a wizard and he can see what's actually there.
Yes. Well, I think not so much... I think other people can see it, but it's the... What?
But he doesn't have a problem. He can see death, because death is actually there, whereas most people just see some shadowy bloke... Probably. Yeah. They see what they expect to see, whereas the wizards see what's actually there. So again, everyone's expecting Kelly to be dead because that's sort of what happened.
Reality
outside of that's what happened outside of the bubble, the decreasing bubble. But he can see she's actually there. So the point is, she doesn't have to fight for him to acknowledge her. He's just a person she can talk to regularly. So in some respects, she's got limited choice. He's just the guy he's about. Yeah, Cutwell's odd because he seems like a bit of a... He sort of reminds me of a kind of like Bertie Wooster type character almost. You know, he's in this role. He mostly just wants to be comfortable. He's doing his job as a wizard. He's quite young. I think he said he's only 20.
Yeah.
But obviously this idea that wizards are always old, I don't know if he's got a beard or not.
I believe he doesn't, so I think it was
well, the picture on the book doesn't, but I don't know. I think that the whole point was
he doesn't have a...
But then she at one point he calls him old Cutwell, and he's like, I'm only 20. But he just seems like a bit of a duffer sort of thing. He's mostly wandering around trying to be comfortable looking for food, making a bit of a mess of things, but also trying to do stuff well. And that's all fine. But then the whole thing with him and Keller's a bit weird because she's 15 and he's 20. And she does seem to treat him like he's a servant. And then kind of, I guess, her main servant, because all the other servants just start crying and looking confused when she speaks to them.
Yeah.
It feels a bit odd because he kind of notices her a bit. But it doesn't go into
There are some bits.
She's clearly wearing an ancestral dress that's for someone much older.
Tying back into this Hawaii book, obviously we do have elements of a romances in here.
Yes.
But, you know.
It's very understated because I think that's just how Pratchett does. That's like his style.
But you do have bits where obviously they're aware that, you shouldn't have an unaccompanied man in the Queen's bedchamber.
And she's just like, oh, it's just she.
Yeah.
It's like in her head, he doesn't even count as a man. He's just like, oh, this is the wizard who's here and he's doing the work for me because he's a servant. I'd say more on Isabel, the romance is much more.
That's much more of a romance. But I was just covering it for the end. But I mean, late at the end of the book, when he's referred to as the master of the Queen's bedchamber, that, it's implying some things that perhaps
in actual terms, people who are like master and think it just means they're the person that like organises the servants to deal with that bit. Or like master of the wardrobe is the person who has charge of the second palace that the king has to keep all of his outfits in.
But also we also have all the jokes about
cut or not doing magic. So it goes back to this thing with wizards where they're supposed to be celibate and it's not super always clear exactly why before this. Yeah. And this book kind of suggests that, I guess, carnal thoughts interrupt magic for wizards at any rate. And so, then at one point, Cutwell accidentally takes too much of some sort of aphrodisiac.
Yes.
And so you're like, oh, okay. And then they're making jokes about how, he doesn't do magic hard at all anymore. But is that just on his side of things? Because I don't feel like we ever get anything from Cutwell's side.
I don't know. It's...
Yeah, it's... I feel like I don't ship it, and also it's a little bit.
Oh yeah, I'm not saying. I think it's.
It feels a bit uncomfortable. Whereas Morton Isabel feels more like a equals.
Yeah, thing. They come to respect each other, and.
And they have a whole thing where after they stop being unpleasant to each other, then have a big thing where they purposefully insult each other. As kind of almost like an activity or a game, and then that's kind of funny and.
Yeah, just no, they're a much better couple within the.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it's an all right character. I think he's not really
Yeah. Speaking of wizards, there's also deaf servant Albert.
He's this older guy. A bit greasy. He likes his fry ups. Eat the pearl ridge.
The thing with Albert is when Mort first encounters him, he's just this slightly cynical, greasy old bloke who's making a load of breakfast and has like a permanent drip on the end of his nose. Because Pratchett does quite a lot of good grotesque, so he's a slightly grotesque sort of figure. But he's sort of helpful to Mort for a bit. But then as the plot progresses and they find out more about him and Mort suddenly realises, he was the wizard, the grand wizard who founded the Unseen University 2,000 years ago. And then him and Isabel start poking into Albert's background, at which point Albert kind of tries to not quite take them out, but he tries to stop them and...
Gets a book dropped on his head.
Yeah, and they sort of have to come to this kind of like grudging relationship of, we need to... get the master back.
Yeah, I think this the situation where death is a wall. Mort is attempting to fix what he's done without telling anyone.
Isabel's helping.
And then they find out that I can't remember how he sees a picture of
it's in one of the books Cutwell has.
Yeah,
because it was written by Alberto Malik.
Yeah. So they find out that he was the great wizard who founded the Unseen University.
Yes, and then he disappeared.
Turns out that he made a deal with death to avoid dying, which was come work for him.
Yeah, Well, I think, again, it's going into the Dungeon Dimensions thing that, that Albert had battled many creepy things that are now waiting for him on the other side, so he's going to avoid that. And also the fact that the amount of time left in his life can be counted in, I think it was days. But when Death's gone missing, he decides, no, he has to get the Master back because he's not pleased with Mort at all. So, particularly as he can see that Mort's starting to take on more deathly aspects.
Yeah.
And I think he understands what that is sooner than Isabel does, although she also notices it. So there's a big statue of him as the founder of the university in, I think, the main square of the university, which has been the focus of many a student prank. And many I don't know if they have...
Many a conotob.
Well, I think this is actually chamber pots, though, because I don't think they have traffic cones in Ankh-Morpork.
But yeah,
yes, that kind of thing, and much graffiti. And then Albert appears, and the statue explodes, and so everyone...
He blows up the statue.
He doesn't like it, he blows it up, doesn't he? And then everyone assumes, oh no, the statue's come to life, and everyone's really scared, because they all defaced it as students. And then Albert takes the wizard faculty, which seems to be in its slightly... old Duffers kind of phase, and not the other kind of...
We're in a fluctuating university.
Yeah, it seems to fluctuate between this is a deadly place full of, like, kind of either vaguely corporate but assassin-y, ruthless, cutthroat sort of people, and these load of academic old Duffers, and it settles eventually, but it's going to flick back and forth a little more. He appears and gets the chief faculty together... And basically sort of says, no more big dinners and everyone has to do exercises.
Yeah,
which is funny because he's been making fry-ups for like 2,000 years.
Yeah.
And then he's like, no, you all have to exercise and get up early.
Obviously, what he'd come up with, his idea of the university was, slightly
more Spartan.
Yeah. And then, of course, we have to point out that because this is not a Discord book without... Winfrey turning up in it, which...
Well, it will be at some point, but... Well, yeah. It wasn't in equal rights. But yeah, I've forgotten Rince. It's like, oh, Rincewind's in this. It's like... I mean, I knew Albert was a wizard, but it's actually gone full wizard. I think the Bursar is introduced in this, vaguely.
He's
not the same... He's not fully the same character, but he's mentioned. And yes, because Rincewind's there, and it's revealed he is now the assistant to the librarian, who's obviously the orangutan. Yes. And then Rincewind kind of sucks up to Albert a bit, and then earns in the enmity of probably a lot of the senior faculty, because at one point he's like, oh, that's it, Albert's telling him off for smoking, which again, it wasn't like he wasn't rolling dog ends all from, like, in Death's kitchen. Yeah, and then Rincewind's like, oh, I never touched the stuff, when he, like, tells off another couple of wizards who are, you know, no doubt in their 50s or older. Yeah. And then they're all looking at him quite annoyed, and then... So Albert makes him do the Rite of Ashkente, which is how you summon death, and that's what pulls death back. But it is touch and go as to whether it would be death or Mort. And then, because death takes him back,
doesn't it? Death takes him back, yeah.
So the university kind of has lucky escape, but then they're like, we'll have to rebuild the statue, but maybe in the cellar.
Yes, they rebuild it fancier and better than ever, and then stick it in a cellar. And lock the door. And
Yes, it seems like Albert was quite a stickler, and then, he's willing to do that again, because it seems like he almost thinks he's going to be sticking around for a while, but he's also getting death back. But he's only got, months?
I think in about 98 days, so it's 90-something. That sticks in my head. I think he's don't know what he's thinking. He's obviously going back to try and...
I wonder if that's his backup plan, because he's obviously not pleased with Mort taking the role at all, which is why he's like, I have to get the Master back. But then, I suppose if that hadn't have worked, then his backup plan is, well, this is my university, and look, it's gone to the dogs, so I'm going to sort it out. And it's like, you also have gone to the dogs. So. But it's been 2,000 years, so fair enough.
Fair enough, yeah, you know, so...
It's been in a skeleton's kitchen the whole time.
I suppose we really do have to touch on death as a minor character in this book.
Well.
So this is the first book where we get death as a character. We've obviously previously seen him in kind of just popping up cameo roles in the other books. And in future books, we'll get death as a main character. And I always enjoy the death books, I think. And so this is kind of the first one where we get the impression that he's intrigued by humanity and humans, and he's trying to understands them a bit, and or not necessarily become, I know he accidentally starts becoming more human, but I think he's just wants to try and see what the fuss is about.
Yeah, well, I think having Mort do the duty means Death has an evening off, which she hasn't had, and so there's always got free time. So I mean, I think the whole thing with him even adopting Isabel is a sign that he was interested in something. The fact that his house looks a bit like human houses, but it's all black and full of skulls. It's like it's like a regular, perhaps slightly upper middle class house, but all the decor is very goth.
Yes.
Although saying that, I think I have Death's desk, or the modern version of it, because I have my black desk and my black laptop and my black monitors. My black keyboard, I put my black phone down on it, and then I can't see it, and I sit there on a black leather chair. Although I imagine his is a bit more like high quality, and mine's just that kind of matte black that everything is nowadays. But yeah, I think he started with that. I mean, obviously he's been around forever, and so that I think that's built up over time. And in some respects, again, does he use the word anthropomorphic personification?
Not in this.
In this, I feel like that's coming. It's that, and I think perhaps we'll go back to it again, that thing that you're human shaped. So even if you aren't human, you're from human blue, you're human shaped, and that affects how you behave. And so Death has had a long time with that and is becoming more like that. But yes, now he actually has the chance to explicitly go out, and so he tries to have fun.
Yeah, experience,
have
fun.
Some leisure.
He goes to a party at the patrician's house. Not that patrician, of a different one, because we're not sure that Vetinari would really have held these sort of parties.
Yeah, a big drunken party where everyone's doing the conga.
Yeah, for like an hour and a half, I believe, as well. It's like an hour and a half long conga. So yeah, he goes to a party, he goes and gambles in the...
He goes fishing.
Goes fishing.
He gets drunk.
Tries to get drunk.
I think he is eventually, he's slurring and stuff.
But then he decides not to be drunk.
And then he decides to get a job.
Yes.
And terrifies a man at what seems to be Ankle Pork's first employment agency.
Yes.
The thing's interesting with this still, though, is that obviously, the idea is that Death... And this is one of the things, is that Mort... Because as Death becomes more human and abandons the duty and Mort takes it on, Mort becomes more Death-like. So his eyes go from brown to blue because Death's eyes are like blue lights deep in the recesses of his skull. And he starts stalking rather than walking. Yeah. And then every so often his voice will... Because when he's trying to do the voice... At one point when he's about to take the witch, she's like, "Don't shout," because his voice has just turned to all caps, which is no need to shout, which is obviously a very funny Pratchett thing where he's
made a joke on
the typeface.
Yeah, Death has a very all capital typeface that's very obvious. So yes, he tries it, but I think I'm intrigued now to go and check to see whether it actually is him doing the voice or him just shouting. I'm actually going to have to.
Are you going to check if there's speech marks?
The witch says
no need to shout, but yes. But the point is, Mort starts doing it more like Death, in that he'll say something, and Isabel will be like, "Wait, say that again." He's like, "What? I just said this," and it'll be normal. Or she'll be like, "Do you know you're doing the voice?" And Isabel can see that he's becoming more like her father, and I think.
Or walking through things by accident.
Well, it's kind of foreshadowed, actually. I realised on this read-through, various things foreshadowed, but at one point, Death says to Mort, when he can walk through walls on his own, then Death will have no more to teach him.
It is in speech marks. So he says, "It haven't," that is, "I haven't got all night, you know." And it's within speech marks.
Yeah, so when the witch is known... So, yeah, I think we're supposed to think it's like when Death says it, but she's like, "No need to shout." So he's actually just kind of shout. He's trying to do it. But later he slips into it without noticing. But the same is obviously he starts walking through walls without noticing and, like, putting his arms through things and, like, Cutwell shoots a crossbow bolt.
Kelly does it by accident.
And then Cutwell does it to test.
Yes, that entire section is just Mort and Kelly are having a conversation.
And Cutwell's just going,
"Hand me that crossbow," say, because he's trying to work out what's going on. He's just seen Mort get shot by a crossbow and he goes straight through him. And he's going, "Just to borrow this a second," and then just at the end he goes, "Thunk," and just shoots him through the chest. And it just it goes straight through
his stress. Yeah. I think it's the fact that Mort is doing it unconsciously initially. Like, if he notices, he'll walk into a wall. That's why he goes to cut all initially. Yeah. But then, as soon as he's not thinking about it, he doesn't. So there's the whole thing where, well, we're definitely getting drunk. Yeah. Mort doesn't get drunk with some incredibly strong drink,
Scumble,
which is very clearly an incredibly distilled version of West Country cider.
Yes, it's normally served in wooden thimbles. You must never let Scumble touch metal. And it's sipped. Whereas
Mort downs, was it a couple of pints?
He downs a pint.
Which the locals in this pub are doing as a joke. And then they're all incredibly freaked out that he's not... They're like, how's he being ill? What's happening? And then he starts to freak out because he can see the kind of wall of reality changing things and heading towards Kelly. And like, oh no, now it's normal. Because he runs in and out to see... Because the pub sign changes from being, what was it, the Queen's Head to the Duke's Head.
Yeah.
And also, like, the various people's things change from people in different positions. The bartender's wearing a different shirt, you know. And then Mort freaks out and he runs through the door, but... Everyone's a bit alarmed because he literally runs through the door. But he didn't notice because he's panicked. But as soon as he notices, he interacts with things, which actually sort of slightly reminds me of Ghosts, the TV show.
Because near the beginning where he's trying to get to see Kelly, he spends a lot of time
running
into a wall because he can't get...
But as he takes on more of the mantle of death, he can just do these things without thinking. And in fact, somebody points out, it's like, you just put your arm through a bedpost. And he's like, what? No, I didn't. Eh? Part of Mort becoming more death-like is that Mort has the realisation, no one invites death to a party. No one says, oh, do you want to come around after work? Which kind of underlies the thing in Flight Fantastic, but... You know, they're a bit like, death's always unwelcome. He's always, you know, he's never wanted. And, you know, Mort kind of has this insight that he must be the loneliest creature in the universe. And there's the whole thing about when everything's done, he's going to put the chairs on the table and turn out the lights on the universe. Yeah. And that's how, in the kind of confrontation later, Mort has a bit of an edge because Mort has almost been death, but death has never been human and Mort has been both. So... Again, it's a slight edge he has, but yeah, death. Because death is still a big skeleton in a cowl. He still has his powers and stuff. He's just not doing the duty, and that's pulling Mort in. But I feel like death's voice starts to change.
It does get occasional, but there doesn't seem
to be much else that's. He's not changing. I think as much as Mort.
I suppose in some respects as well. For a lot of work, so when he's the cook and he talks about, you know, the time and things, he's got a unique perspective on the universe. Mm-hmm. So if anything, he's doing magic or using shortcuts within the universe.
I think he's just making the food, but he's not using time to do it as a human.
The point is, he's not using the death power. Mm-hmm. The death power. It's just because he's an entity that is outside of the normal rules of reality, death or not death.
It's interesting, though, how people view death a bit. I mean, again, this idea that he's always unwelcome, but obviously various cultures have different things of that. I mean, the thing with the abbot...
I was going to say that both of the Mort actually succeeds at the abbot and Goody, they welcome him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing with the abbot is that he's constantly reincarnating. It's clearly a take on the Dalai Lama type thing. And it's a new person. He's like, oh, have you bought the round? Like it's a milk round or something. He's like, oh, is the franchise under new ownership? You know, it's, oh, bought the round off the other guy, have you? It's like, which again, vaguely foreshadows kind of that Mort takes on more of it, but it's just that the guy's like, oh, is this the round, is it? Yes, which is kind of funny. There's also the whole what authority death has, because the whole thing with Kelly and how she should die, and then although that's a bad thing and like her murderous relative becomes, you know, king, it then ushers in a load of peace, because if you look at the broader view of history, but... Death still kind of mentions the gods or fates. Oh, the gods won't be happy. Yeah. And it's sort of weird because later on you sort of feel like death's over the gods and is more important than them. But at this point, they still seem to be distant but kind of important. Yeah. Which I think, I mean, I don't know if maybe small gods is when Pratchett kind of deals with that side of things. Because I'll have to settle it with the gods. And I'm like, having read all of it, like, do you? What have they got?
We've only seen, because we saw the gods in Colour of Magic, but we only saw... you know, a few of
them kind of game playing and stuff and manipulating things. And although this does, I think it does mention in this book about gods exist because of belief. So I think this is where the idea first gets mentioned, although obviously it would be built on massively later on. You know, that's a bit like, we have to do the duty. Kelly is supposed to die and this is how history goes. But then later he kind of wangles it a bit and it's not...
Well, that's primarily because they... So, I mean, so I suppose we should... Yeah, we're getting on to the ending here.
Yes, true, yeah.
Before we move on, do we have anything on other characters we want to touch on or any of the plot points?
I think
there's
the main characters. I guess the plot points, I think it's just that, you know, more things were foreshadowed than I realised. So like Death saying, you know, to Moore, oh, when you can walk through walls on your own, I'll have nothing more to teach you. The fact that people not seeing Death is then laced like people not seeing Kelly.
I think I've got a couple of things to touch on. This is the book where we get the famous line of, I can murder a curry.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, crops up pretty much wherever Death turns up in other media. This is the book where he murders a curry. And flipping onto that, so we have representations of other...
It's that touring the disc thing, because if you think about most of all the books thus far are like, people are going to kind of tour various bits of the disc, or so obviously Mort's going to different bits of the disc and sees all these things that humans wouldn't normally see, like... The way the disc looks when the sun is underneath and it shines out through the rimfall.
Cool.
The fact that Death's in Ankh-Morpork, which is obviously supposed to be some sort of like British-style city, but there's obviously curry houses, and then he runs into Moore, ends up running into the house of a family who are kind of like Middle Eastern.
Well, they're Atlantean.
Which isn't well defined at this point, but it's kind of like Middle Eastern / and a sort of South Asian.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's a bit stereotypical.
And the thing about it, you know, they worship the god Ofla, and you know,
oh, the crocodile one.
Yeah, and
it's a bit more Egyptian, isn't it? But that thing, that's Arabic. So
yeah, but the whole thing that, you know, they expect him to be a demon, and they respect him because he's a demon.
I mean, there's no reason Pratchett had to write that. He could have just written that like a sort of, you know, middle class white sounding family that Mort joined in. And so he's kind of including some diversity into it, because the whole point is that the father of that family had served a mysterious gentleman in his job as a waiter at the curry place. So it's sort of showing Ankh-Morpork as a diverse city, even if some of it's a bit stereotypical. But then you have Mort, and, you know, obviously Mort himself is from the mountains, and then he goes to see a witch. Is it the same mountains somewhere?
Yeah, I think it's
it's all the Ramtop stuff, isn't it? But then he also goes to take somebody who's in a pyramid in not Egypt. Sort, is it?
Yeah.
It's kind of, you're doing a little bit more of a tour of the disc, but this is kind of more of a, because you see Death's Domain more, so kind of, it's less of a travel log as, you know, the first three books were, but there's a bit more hopping about places. And the fact that Mort has to take something from Sort and then go over to Stone Lat, which is like stuff's on the opposite side of the disc.
Yeah, and I mean we you know, most of it is set in Stone Lat as well, which is a bit of a
Well, Stone Lat's actually a massive glacial erratic. Well, it's a big rock that was left there when the ice giants were there. And that the city was built on it. And I'm like, oh, that's glacial erratic. Because even now, glacial erratics, there's whole things about like rocks being chucked by, a giant. And it's probably pretty much a metaphor for glaciers. And so he's just literalized that a bit. The city in a kingdom that's very, very rural, but is also very flat, unlike the mountain rural stuff you get in later books.
Very cabbagey. Yes, very cabbagey. Very cabbagey. But yes, an interesting representation of the Clatchian family. I'm not sure how I feel about that so much as...
It does feel a bit uncomfortable now, but on the other hand, again, you know, he's included a bit of diversity, but it's kind of based on stereotypes. But it's still mostly kind of for gags a little bit.
It was, yeah. Because obviously he's walked through a wall and then...
And they're all surprised, and you know, he's surprised because he doesn't know how he walked through the wall.
Multi-generational family and with the
grandparents
just kind of getting in on the food while the others are distracted.
Yeah, I mean, It doesn't feel like it's particularly punching down.
No.
But maybe it feels like slightly uncomfortable.
But I think it's just an evolving...
Yeah.
Anyway, that's...
The other thing I was going to say is we get, you know, there's various... There's a lot of the humours in there, you know, like the murderer curry, no need to shout. Stuff like, there's a bit where the scene changes and Pratchett literally writes out a scene changing. But like... The image fades, and somebody asks a question and somebody else says something. It's like, oh, she wasn't actually talking to him. This is a clever cinematic trick. So he like does a cinematic trick in text, explains the trick and undercuts it as he does that. And then says, well, it might be called this, but who knows what something's called in an industry where a seasoned professional is called the best boy. So he like puts a weird nudge in at like television professionals. It's just funny that he kind of like, adapts a visual trick to print and then immediately explains the conceit as he's doing it.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of thing he does with the sort of like narrative voice just doing these odd, interesting things, which I think that's what makes this a good starting point, because a lot of the humour of Pratchett and these bits are clever and odd are in there more and more.
Definitely. So the ending.
Yes.
So the ending is pretty much a big fight scene between Death and Mort.
Mort is human and can get tired and stuff, but he has been Death for a bit. Death's never been human.
But they're
also, and others are helping Mort.
They're doing this in the
lifetime
regime. So in the Discord, everyone has a lifetimer, which shows
big hourglass.
Well, I think that. Smallish hourglasses.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, it's their hourglasses.
Some things have bigger hourglasses than others, but the normal human ones are sort of reasonably sized ones. Okay. But they're doing it, so there's this room's full of lifetimers.
Like sand through the hourglass. I think even in the book, Pratchett says, you know, some metaphors are just not very subtle. I can't remember the exact wording, but he kind of points out it's not a very subtle metaphor. But yeah.
So, they're having this big fight in the hourglass room, which results in many unexplained and odd deaths
or near misses
as hourglasses are knocked onto the floor or caught by
several people suddenly were falling and then all have miraculous rescues and somebody like falls off a cliff but it's like lands in a bush because Isabel caught the lifetime
and then some just people kill them. And in this situation they end up killing I use in inverted commas, destroying the lifetimer of the Duke who was supposed to become king.
Who assassinated Kelly and her father.
Which is obviously now very useful because there's now a gap.
A vacancy. It's interesting that Kelly, I suppose, being a historically significant figure, being a royal, there's this whole bubble. But all these other people, you know, the ones who die, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
And, like, no one's worried about history twanging then. Is it because they're like, regular folk who probably aren't going to affect much?
Unless...
Or is it that Death puts it right in the sudden jump cut from, we're having this fight, Death's almost won, Mort's tried his best, what's happening? Does Death slap him?
I think,
Because Death has that thing where he's a bit like, what is it, you know, you've come to my house, you've seduced my daughter, it's something about seducing daughter and failing at the duty, and it's like, all in all, not a good start to your first job, boy. Which, and then Mort's like, Mort. And I also have that in my head because it's in the animated version of Soul Music. Yes. And so that's why I can hear just that one bit in the voice of Christopher Lee. But yes, it's... And then suddenly Death starts laughing and just...
Well, doesn't Isabel say... I love him,
Isabel says she loves him. And then Death sort of... doesn't have much facial expression because he's literally a skull. But he sort of laughs. And everyone's a bit like, what's happening? Because, you know, Kelly and Cutwell have been brought to Death's domain to try and figure out what's going to kind of save her and... it's the only place she's safe. And then suddenly there's a jump cut to the end. So it feels a little bit like some Doctor Who episode, which is a bit like, and then something happened, and now we're here. And it's like, all right.
So obviously...
what happened there? And it's like, oh, TARDIS or something.
So, yeah, I think for what they say, they kind of find themselves in a field, you know...
outside
Stone's Slat. And basically ends up that, you know, the Duke is dead, so they need someone so...
So Keller's alive. People can see her.
Morty
is the queen.
Morty is slotted in to replace the Duke of Stowhillet.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Mort becomes Duke. Basically, they mention this, but what happens is from the point of view of reading, it jump cuts to suddenly there is a wedding.
Yes.
And Mort is there. And then it turns out it's Mort and Isabel's wedding. So they've now got married and they're now Duke and Duchess of Stowhillet. And the whole point is that, well, having done this, knowing that there has to be like 100 years of peace, but the Duke who would somehow... I feel like not on purpose, but just because history is like that. They're now going to have to try and make that happen themselves. And then Death didn't come to the ceremony, but has turned up at the reception. Weirdly, doesn't go and see his own daughter, which I feel is a bit like, all right. Yeah. He just has a chat with Mort. So they have a bit of a chat about what's happening. And, well, there's first of all the fact that in the fight, what we didn't mention, I suppose, is that Mort's lifetimer is about to run out.
Yes.
And then what Death does is he turns it upside down. And it's sort of alluded to the fact that if he was 16, his lifetime got turned upside down, how long does that give him? He's like, well, we'll not think about that too much. There's also reference, again, foreshadowing, although I don't know if Pratchett meant it that at the time, of, oh, you know, how does Death feel about being grandfather? And he's a bit like, he doesn't think that's his kind of thing. Yeah. He doesn't have the right kind of knees.
Yeah.
And then Death gives more, I'm assuming also Isabel, a present, and it's a pearl. And it's actually what was made from that bubble.
The bubble of reality collapsing.
When the universe ends, that could be the seed of a new universe. He says, it's a future as well as a present. And I read that, I was like, oh, yeah. So it's like, oh, this is very profound, but also obviously a pun. It's all things have been put right, but we haven't seen the process of the putting right. It's just like, now we're here. So it does seem a little bit like, it's like, what happens now? And then things were fine. It's like, all right. So I'd say the ending... it's satisfying, but a little bit...
yeah.
Sort of jumping ahead, and now it's this.
They kind of... yeah. I think so far the endings of the books...
endings are tricky, but yeah. Yeah. And a lot of these aren't the stories that are like... well, I mean, I suppose, you know, the farm boy goes on adventure, learns more about the world, saves the princess, and then there's a wedding at the end. Like, there's sort of an outline of that.
Yes. But
yes, there's not the jump. And I mean, I suppose it's not unusual. It's like, oh, we've had the final battle, and now we're going to have the wedding or the ceremony or something at the end. It's not unusual for it to be that. It just feels a bit like, oh, I've squared it with the gods now. It's like, but that seemed like the thing that was causing all the trouble before and was the main plot of the books. Oh, I've just sorted it.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good then, isn't it?
Well, that's good.
But I don't think it takes away from the enjoyment of the story so much. No. It just might be a bit like, oh okay.
Overall, I think we've thoroughly enjoyed Mort.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have anything or more in the notes?
No, I think that is everything I was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, if you're going to start anywhere in the Discworld, this is not a bad place to start.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you lose some of the references like who Rincewind is, and you know, but that doesn't really matter.
It was just a cameo, really, that, isn't it?
And yes, the first appearance of Isabel, but again, that doesn't really matter.
Much like the earlier appearances of Death himself, it feels like there was quite a character change, you know, by the time we got to this book, which is, you know, fair enough.
But I mean, the thing, this is much closer. This is the Death we're expecting now going forward, who we'll see he'll cameo in at least all of the books, at least, which is...
as well as his own series, like more.
So definitely a good one to start with, but definitely feels a bit YA.
I mentioned online about having read this, like on social media, and somebody said that it had been chosen for their reading group, which I got the impression wasn't necessarily a genre-specific group. And that person said they'd enjoyed it, but they did say other people in the group had bounced off and said it was for kids. So I think when this was published, things were either... for adults or children, YA was less of a...
It kind of fell into the gap.
It's simply
not a thing.
It's kind of been with... various things have been published since. It's kind of become a niche of its own.
There's various books that I read that were categorised as adults. So the David Eddings, Bell Garrett, too, which is similar, in fact, because, again, Farm Boy ends up marrying Princess Magic User. But that is now YA... Whereas I was reading it when it was when I was
well, 11. I mean, why has very much become its own genre with its own tropes yeah. and things that happen, and like so much stuff is in first person and the way things are, so it's become its own thing. But I think, yeah, this certainly feels like the kind of book that you could say like this would be geared towards teenagers.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, because I have read books for teenage protagonists, you know, published more recently, that although didn't quite feel like YA because it felt like it was a different genre. So it's a bit interesting because obviously that didn't exist at the time, but it definitely feels like, because Pratchett obviously writes stuff that is explicitly YA later when that becomes more of a thing. But it feels like this could have slotted into
I mean, like, you could argue that a lot of the Discworld stuff could have is okay to be read by teenagers anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
it's okay to be, but it's not necessarily like about, like, the focus is usually on young people or like a transitional time.
Yes,
in a person's life. Like if you think of Cast of Wonders, which is the sort of YA podcast from Escape Artists, their thing is the story doesn't have to be about young people, but it's usually about perhaps a transitional time or people experiencing something for the first time, because that's what a lot of their audience, you know, that's the point of life they're in.
In my role, if someone came to me and asked, is, you know, would Discworld, you know, the early Discworld stuff be all right for, you know, 14-15-year-old?
Hey.
I wouldn't say no, because, you know, I mean, Tiffany Akin is there, but, you know.
But they don't have to start.
But they don't have to start there. But it's got the content-wise, it's not.
As I said before, you know, Pratchett has a lot of, like, strong young women, and a lot of them are, you know, on the young side. But also he's got older women, and obviously with equal rights, there's like a child and an old lady.
Yeah.
But yeah, later there are quite a lot throughout. Well, I think the characters kind of grow up as we read them, but certainly the early stuff, there are a lot of characters who are, you know, just starting out in adulthood or life. So yeah, that does make sense.
Yeah. But anyway, we shall draw this to a close. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back again, where we will be tackling another book about magic in sorcery.
Yeah, it's another Rincewind.
Another Rincewind book. If we hadn't seen enough of it, don't worry, there are less books about Rincewind as we go forwards. We're going to get to Witches and Guards, the Guard series soon.
Well, in fairness, we have had a witch series, but I'm sure we already discussed how that one feels.
Proto-witch book, I think, at that point.
Yeah.
Where much, you know, in some respects, this is...
still very wizardy.
Yeah. But yes, that's something.
Anyway, that will be for the next time.
Next time. Anyway, yes.
So thank you very much for listening.
And goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Dining Table Discworld. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/diningtablediscworld. You can also find us on Blue Sky at DT Discworld. All our other contact information and credits for our music can be found in our show notes. Thank you for listening again, and we'll see you in our next episode.